You're listening to 104.3 and 104.7 KHUM. Cotton, Eureka, Arcata, and Transitor K282AD in good old Ferndale. Streaming to the world over at KHUM.com. We have Stop the Violence going on right now for the next several days. And then we have the Start the Healing celebration on Saturday. Make sure to go on out. It's over at the Eureka Women's Club. Jim Lawman Band's playing. And the proceeds are going to Stop the Violence. And they'll have the whole check presentation and everything else happening. So make your plans to pop on by there on Saturday evening, Eureka Women's Club. But today's topic for Stop the Violence is on pervasive sexual harassment. And I thought it would be a great idea to talk to Maxwell Schnur, who's a professor of the Stop to End Sexualized Violence classes over at HSU, because I wanted to talk about some proactive measures that we can all take to help stop sexualized violence. Now, in addition to teaching the Act to End Sexualized Violence courses, Maxwell also has a ton of other qualifications. Maxwell, do you want to give me a quick rundown?
Sure. I'm the chair of the communication department here at HSU, and I also chair the Sexual Assault Prevention Committee, which is the large clearinghouse organization which does basically all the work to prevent and respond to sexualized violence at Humboldt State and beyond. I've been teaching the Act to End Sexualized Violence class for 12 years, and I also teach the Act to End Sexualized Violence 2 kind of advanced seminar.
Okay, sweet. And what happens in the Act to End Sexualized Violence class? How do you even go about starting with the class?
Sure. I mean, the core of it is a curriculum to challenge rape culture. And so it's based on a ton of work to kind of understand the ways that oppression works to reduce the value of some living people in our community. And so you might kind of have to understand the intersectional nature of violence, which is that not everybody's body counts as much as other people's bodies. And so we kind of start there, and then we run through a lot of media analysis, a lot of kind of understanding where we are in kind of the national moment. And then we spend a fair amount of time talking about ethical actions to challenge rape culture. How do you actually do things to make the community that we're in safer? And some of this might be internal work. Some of this might be institutional work. So there's a lot of pieces that advocate for HSU to do things differently or better. And some of it might be interpersonal work. Like you might necessarily want to talk to roommates or classmates or teammates about some of the ideas that you've learned in the class.
Or sometimes there's some rhetoric that you even can find within yourself, or ideas you find within yourself that you can also identify from this. So the first step is identifying a lot of the things that lead to this being a rape culture. How would somebody go about that?
It's pretty common to find ourselves inconsistent. You know, you may very well be aware that everyone should be equal and people shouldn't be subject to violence, and then buy a favorite hip-hop album and realize that the person you just sent some money to is sort of inconsistent with your personal values, or you might say something like that. And I think that guilt is usually one of those primary ways that people wind up not thinking that they're qualified to put in work or engage. And I would just encourage people to realize that there's always a space to make a difference and be an advocate for culture change about violence. And I mean, I would say we could start with some of the fundamentals, right? Number one, the vast majority of people who are harmed by someone that they know. The stereotype is that rapists are people who jump out of the bushes and attack someone. We know that about 85% of the people who are harmed are hurt by roommates, study buddies, people that they already know. And so we need to kind of pivot our responses to sexualized violence to be a little more specific to that. Lighting in public spaces doesn't actually respond to the problems where most sexualized violence is. We need to actually talk about consent culture. We need to do real capacity building work in terms of communication, that sort of thing. I would also challenge all the victim blaming that comes out, that a lot of is pretty common, right? And especially thinking about Roy Moore and conversations about Harvey Weinstein right now. I mean, a lot of the amazing stuff we're seeing is the visibility of disbelief of survivors. And we know that almost no survivors make things up. It's not generally a great world for people who come forward and say, someone raped me, someone harassed me, somebody, or I'm a survivor of domestic violence. Like, that's not actually something most people tend to want to do. Usually when they come forward, it's a rare and generous moment. And so in your life, like for all the listeners out there, if you wind up hearing someone say, you know, oh, I would like to blame this person, what they were wearing, where they were, what they do for an occupation, how much they drink, for a moment of violence, please remember that the responsibility of violence is solely on the shoulders of someone who hurts. It's never on the person who's on the receiving end. And we could also just note that there's very little that survivors can usually do. I mean, the idea that sexual violence is triggered because of someone's dress or demeanor or geography is really, really bogus. And one of the most kind of radical things we can do in our own lives is challenge those things at the dinner table and kind of disrupt those sorts of narratives.
Why do you think people victim blame in the first place?
Well, I think it's a sense of like comfort, right? It allows you to organize the world to imagine that there are rules. And rapists and abusers don't play by rules. It allows you to say that if you can project that someone else shouldn't have worn something, let's say, oh, well, you were drunk at the bar and I saw you that night and as a result you got hurt and that's partially your fault. Stop. Back up. Realize that you're victim blaming. The choice to harm someone wasn't because someone was drunk. The consequences of being drunk should be a hangover. They're not necessarily sexual assault. And so I think the desire is to imagine that the world operates based on these kinds of rules. And I think that's where victim blaming mostly comes from, is a hope to kind of organize the world in some sense of coherence to be able to, you know, make sense of tragedy and violence in our community.
Would it be perhaps maybe because they don't want to think that it could happen to them?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Besides that, is there any other steps that people can go ahead and take to, you know, change some of the culture?
Well, sure. I mean, I think one of the things would be being ready to be a really productive, supportive friend when somebody discloses. And you're never really ready, but I would put the phone number of North Coast Rape Crisis Team into your cell phone, for instance. And so that phone number is 445-2881.
And those ladies are very nice.
Yeah. And non-ladies.
Non-ladies and men and other people, yeah. Right.
But I think the real value is having that in a cell phone so that when somebody says, I'm not sure what to do, I'm not sure who to talk to, that here on the North Coast we have a phenomenal service organization, North Coast Rape Crisis Team, who works with survivors of any age, any gender, any place, that need help and need advice. And if you want to know what talking to the cops is like about a domestic violence case, they're a great resource. If you want to know about counselors in the area who are aware and informed about sexualized violence, they're a phenomenal resource. If you just need somebody to talk to, they would be the great resource. And so I would urge folks who want to be caring friends not to play a non-role. Like, I don't think you should become a fake investigator. I don't think you should imagine yourself as a counselor. I think you should actually be a really good friend to somebody who tells you that they were hurt and bridge them to the resources that they might need.
What if they don't want to call the resources?
Then I think you support their play, right? I mean, I think one of the philosophies that I adhere to is survivor-centeredness. What does that survivor actually want and need? And everybody's healing and coping with violence is going to look really differently. And you can't imagine that everybody's going to do the same thing, want to talk to the cops, want to talk to a counselor, want to do X or Y. And you might want something for them that they don't want. And you have to kind of listen and let them guide the process. Otherwise, I mean, one of the terrible things about rape or domestic violence or harassment or sexual assault is that the choice was taken away from that other person. And in the name of best intentions, oftentimes well-meaning friends will take the choice away from that person. Well, they didn't want to do this, so I've got this person on the phone for you here. And that's I think it's a bad look. I think listening, believing, trusting are going to be those first stages. And then when that person needs help, they'll usually tell you what they actually need. Being survivor-centered is a real vital part of this. Especially if folks know the perpetrator as well as the survivor, they'll oftentimes say, like, oh, I can't believe that. And that's really not that productive, right, for the survivor. It really suggests that their voice doesn't count or doesn't count the same weight. And that's a big part of rape culture.
Let's say that somebody listening may have been on the other end of things, maybe had engaged in things that nobody ever should. How, besides never going to those actions ever again, what sort of steps should they take?
I'm a little hesitant to suggest anything for potential perpetrators. I mean, I think the accountability steps are mostly well known within our kind of society of what people could do. You know, you could talk to authorities, you could talk to a counselor and get help yourself. But I would fundamentally say that you should probably get some help. And I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I mean, that's what I would say, you know, initially. Mostly at HSU, we tend to work on prevention and response to incidences of violence. And the hope is that rather than responding after something tragic has happened, can we change the culture to make it less likely that somebody who was thinking about violence would suddenly be like, oh, wait a minute, that's a bad decision. Or we oftentimes think about intervening in the moment of harm, which is, you know, I'll give a shout out to our amazing Check It program up here.
Oh, yeah. I was just talking to a good friend of mine on the way over here.
Yeah. That. I mean, it's an astounding grassroots movement here on campus, which basically says to students, from other students, I've got your back. I'm willing to have your back in a moment of difficulty. In almost all moments of harm in our society, there's someone around, right? There's somebody around. And most of the time, we just kind of pretend we didn't notice. We're at a party and somebody's leading someone else drunk off into a room, or we're out in the street and we hear two folks fighting and we just kind of say, oh, that's none of my business. And part of this new culture is to say, wow, maybe I'm not necessarily going to go get in the middle of this fight, but is there some way I could either distract, delegate, or directly intervene in this moment of harm? And to do that with like strategic thinking is pretty radical.
How would somebody go about intervening?
Well, I mean, you probably those three Ds, right? Distract, directly intervene, or delegate. Generally, I mean, it kind of depends on what kind of person you are. Sure. I mean, if we were thinking about, let's say we were outside where somebody was, we could hear a couple fighting and it seemed like it was on the verge of potential abuse or some kind of battering kind of situation, you might distract by maybe honking the car horn a bunch or turning on the lights and kind of pointing at them in that sense that there's something which kind of disrupts that moment. And you might want to think about your own safety and security in those moments. I wouldn't want anybody, especially guys out there. There's a lot of the old Western sense of direct confrontation. And so it takes a certain amount of strategic thinking for male-identified people to intervene in moments of harm and not necessarily start more conflict or fight. And so, you know, I think distracting might be pulling a fire alarm or spilling a drink at a party or disrupting in some way like that. You might directly intervene where you might say, hey, I noticed that you're in my math class and I wanted to check in with you and see if you were all right. You seem pretty wasted. Everything okay? And sometimes people are fine and they just – you want to know what's going on. And so you might directly intervene and then you might delegate too. It's possible that you're like, okay, well, I don't know those people. I don't know anything that's going on. Maybe that's a moment where you do wind up calling the authorities or checking in with the host of the party you're at and saying, hey, look, you know, I don't know the folks who are here, but this is your party. I just saw these weird folks kind of going off into a room, and it looks like one of them's pretty trashed. That's, you know, just thinking broadly about the possible spectrum of choices that you have, rather than just saying violence isn't my responsibility, kind of standing aside while something happens.
Oh, yeah. That would be the worst, is somebody experiencing violence to have other people just standing by and not doing anything about it.
And I think in most cases there are other folks around. And I think about some really amazing kind of bystander moments. In the case of the Stanford survivor who was in the news maybe about a year ago, a particularly horrific sexual assault that happened where the perpetrator got a very short sort of jail sentence. There were a pair of bicyclists who drove by watching the assault happen, hopped off their bikes and said, hey, what are you doing? Yelled and then chased the guy down. And that's maybe a slightly romantic version of things, but it just says just because you're out on a midnight bike ride doesn't necessarily mean that you wouldn't see something and couldn't do anything about it. Your positionality has a lot to do with it, right? And I think, you know, power, expectations of gender, standing and status are all things that you'd want to pay attention to in those moments.
If somebody wanted to get involved or learn more about the Check It program, which is really amazing, how would they go about doing so?
You can go to Check It HSU, and that's the website. You can also Google them. And see, they have pretty regular workshops for HSU students. They have a fair amount of projects. They have retreats, trainings. The peer educators through Check It do a lot of kind of outward-looking work, and they're always looking for students who are interested in getting involved. And so I think that's probably the best access point, is to just contact them directly.
Okay, and it's mostly for students, but members of the community, do they have any resources online for them?
You know, for members of the community, I think that I would go to some of the other standing resources, right? Humboldt State has humboldt.edu/stoprape, which is our website, which is anti-violence resources for the community, sort of best paths, that kind of stuff. You might think about some of the national organizations as well. I'll give a shout out to Know Your Nine, which is the national Title IX organization that does a lot of advocacy. If you're looking for, you know, it kind of depends on what the folks are looking for. If they want to get involved in organizing in this community, you might check in with one of the sort of service organizations like North Coast Rape Crisis Team and see if there's a good place for you to volunteer or donate. Those are things that I think would always be welcome.
Oh, yeah, and they definitely need a lot of people to volunteer and donate a lot. Yeah, and their website.
NCRCT.org. And, you know, just a phenomenal resource. You know, one of the folks in our community, they've been doing it longer and with more experience than most of us. And so they're a pretty fantastic group of folks who really work hard to support and believe survivors. I think, you know, I mean, maybe there's a moment to mention the kind of national moment where many folks like Louis C.K., political leaders are sort of being marked and identified as perpetrators of violence. And it's a little difficult for many folks who kind of care about some of these folks to imagine that they could be harming people. And I
know Bill Crosby was really hard for a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would want to say just that I think, you know, being a nice person doesn't necessarily mean that you're not a perpetrator. And there's a really important moment to believe and engage with survivors right now. Very few survivors make things up. This is a moment where our culture is kind of shifting. And I think those who refuse to shift with this cultural moment will be left behind and maybe even marked for their unwillingness to kind of listen. I mean, at the most revolutionary and radical for people in this community, it would be in their own personal circle. There's 40 or 50 people that you know and love and care about. Are you willing to talk honestly about sexualized violence in your circle of friends and family? Are you willing to listen to and believe the people around you who might disclose? And are you willing to try to offer to share whatever resources you can to bridge people to get appropriate help rather than, let's say, faking the funk and beginning your own private investigation, which is a terrible idea, or imagining that you're a counselor when you don't have that kind of capacity? Share, believe, and listen, and then bridge folks is, I think, the real work of our community.
Well, thank you so much for taking a little bit of time to talk to me.
You bet. You bet. Thank you, Bailey.
Cool. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I will say that, you know, I'm really proud of the work that HSU does. For, you know, more than a decade, we've been a forerunner in prevention and immediate approaches to respond. And we integrate law enforcement, staff and faculty training, policy construction, as well as prevention in really robust ways. In fall, we started the Students for Consent Culture Living Community, which is the first in the nation, where students can live in the residence hall in a themed living area, which is driven by consent. We're Obama White House It's On Us awardee, where we're recognized as one of the best programs in the nation. We're a Department of Justice program identified as one of the more successful places. HSU, I think, sometimes is not particularly well known for some of this, but we're a national leader in challenging sexualized violence, and that's something I'm really proud of in our community, which is that I don't think we do everything right, but this is one of those places where we legitimately probably deserve some kudos.
And you don't have to answer this question, but how did you find yourself in the spot of teaching the ACT to End Sexualized Violence course? How did your life
I got a phone call from some of my colleagues who were putting together the first ACT to End Sexualized Violence class. Mm-hmm. And there was a prominent stranger rape on campus, just off campus. And there was a big rally where students in an Ethics for Action class walked out and called for a student walkout in order to respond. And an administrator took the microphone at this walkout and said some inappropriate things. And there was this sudden realization that we were missing this educational moment on campus. And so a group of folks volunteered to get together to make this this one-unit weekend class, the ACT End Sexualized Violence class, and to say, look, we can do this. We could actually make a curriculum which challenges rape culture and make it as a credit-bearing class within the university institution system.
And it's grown so much since then, which is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think about, you know, probably about 800 students have traveled through that class, and a staggering number of them have done projects, right? So that Students for Consent Culture project that I just named originated as a student project in that class. A student said, boy, what if we had a residence hall that was consent-themed, and then ran with a small project and made it happen? And so there's something amazing about thinking, you know, we tend to think about all the folks you just kind of pass on campus as just random people. but the hundreds and hundreds of people who've put in work here to make the place safer and to support survivors is kind of an amazing cultural moment. It really separates HSU from other places.
And it really reverberates and expands from there because those people talk to other people who talk to other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then eventually we have a culture change, which we need.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the primary goal is how do you change the culture to make violence so unthinkable that it's just a complete aberration and a weird moment. And unfortunately, we know that's not the case, that a lot of people are still harmed. There's a lot of work still to be done.
Well, at least a lot of people are being held accountable, especially celebrities nowadays, for those kind of actions.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. And let's hope that that is more broadly understood in our society, that some folks who have access to great resources sometimes get sort of sympathetic treatment. And I think it's really important to think about some of the access points like race, class, gender identity, sexual orientation that sometimes don't make those survivors as believable in the sort of mainstream society. And so I think violence has a particular direction in our society, and it often points at the most disadvantaged. It's really important if we're thinking about culture change to not just imagine this as a single access point. We need to also think about the interrelationship, let's say, between houselessness and domestic violence. We need to think about the relationship between the prison industrial complex and sexualized violence and domestic violence. We need to think about these entwined problems rather than just thinking about it as sort of single issue.
That's definitely for sure. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and take a short break, and then we'll get back into the tunes here in a bit, and this will be posted online over at khum.com shortly. You're listening to KHUM.